Species.
Unite.
Species. Unite.
Humans are a puny thing by comparison. I often ask myself, why is it that wolves don't kill people, or extremely rarely? I mean, it does exist, but it's almost totally off the charts. Unlike tigers and lions and leopards and cougars, and there's all kinds of predator bears, especially we have, up here every year, there may be a person or two that may get killed up here in Alaska from brown bears, that there's lots of big carnivores that do occasionally cross the line and kill humans. But why not wolves? And if you look at these different predators, it has a lot to do, I think, with how they're raised.
Hi, I'm Elizabeth Novogratz. This is Species Unite. We have a favor to ask. If you like today's episode and you have a spare minute, could you please rate and review Species Unite on Apple Podcasts or wherever you listen to podcasts? It really helps people to find the show. This conversation is with Dr. Paul Joslin. Paul is a wildlife biologist who has spent decades with wolves and other predators all over the world. And in my quest to understand the wolf hatred that seems to permeate the United States, especially Montana, Idaho, and Wyoming, where we're slaughtering all the wolves. But really, it's all over the planet. People just hate wolves. So I asked Paul to come on the show to give his two cents as to why so many of us fear and hate an animal that does almost zero harm to us.
Hello, Elizabeth. How are you? And thanks for inviting me for your podcast.
Thank you, Paul. How are you?
Well, doing fine. It's not often I get to talk these days about wolves, so here I am.
I have talked to quite a few people about wolves because I'm just so devastated of what we are doing, what we've always done and are doing, especially in the U.S. Like, it's such insane levels what we're doing to wolves. And you are the first person I have talked to who has worked with wolves since the 60s. Most people I've talked to, and they consider themselves old timers in the wolf world, they started in the 90s when wolves were reintroduced.
I had the good fortune to literally have spent several decades either involved with wolf research or associated with various conservation leading kind of projects. The beginning, I was second year student at University of British Columbia. And I had heard that there's this fellow, Dr. Douglas Pinmott, out in Ontario. He headed the research program on wolves for Ontario, that he was looking for a couple assistants to assist him. So I wrote him a letter, and as luck would have it, I was, you know, one of the students that he hired. And what he said was that he'd like us to begin to help and try to understand what wolves did in the summertime. Much was known by people flying with airplanes in winter over snow-covered lands and whatever, but not much was known about what wolves did, particularly in forests in the summertime. And in those days, radio tracking was just in its infancy, but he'd come up with another idea that he had some captive wolves that he'd played some recordings to and discovered they would answer back. And it dawned on him that maybe this could be used as a field technique. You know, why not go out and howl for wolves, as it were? And he devised two projects in Algonquin Park in Ontario. It's a 3,000 square mile park with about 100 wolves in it. He came up with two projects. He thought that he'd have one of us, John Theberge, to go out in the wilderness, and he'd give him assistant and canoe over 1,000 square miles and just hunt for wolves and find out how many packs he could find in a 1,000 square miles. My part, he thought, well, I want you to find one wolf pack and try to stick with it. That's your job. You got to go out, help make a connection with wolves and see if you can stay with them for the summer. He had provided us with what was called a Call of the Wild unit. It's a record player that he'd recorded his own captive wolves on, and a big metal loudspeaker, and a giant-sized battery that ran all this stuff. You carried that in your backpack and set off. And the idea was, about every mile or so, set up your equipment, blast a couple of times, and see if you might be lucky enough to hear wolves. And just do this over and over and over again. After finding wolves and discovering, hey, you can follow them this way, not only can you follow them, we discovered that after they leave the den, taking their pups with them, they'll take and park their pups, you know, a mile or just a few miles away to another spot and just leave them there while they hunt out from there. So you could set up your tent literally within a few hundred yards of where the wolves were and howl back and forth, get to know who's home tonight and who isn't. When they would up and move, I would go in and check it all out. And in the process, discovered that, hey, all this malarkey about the big bad wolf is just that. It's malarkey. By the end of the first summer, I had 15% better success howling myself than I did using the recording, which weighed a ton and a lot of equipment. Not that us humans can howl better than a wolf, because these were recordings of them. I think there are two factors going on. One is that they were Doug's captive pack, so that's a whole pack of wolves. And wolves are territorial, and, you know, imagine you're maybe a single wolf moving around and you hear a whole pack of wolves. I don't know if I want to respond back. It's a little risky from their perspective. The other is that our hearing range at night, we'll hear wolves about a mile away at max, normally, somewhere in that range. When you blast a recording over a loudspeaker, you may be triggering wolves maybe up to 4 miles away. I mean, their hearing is much better than ours. And for wolves, howling is a real big emotional outlet. And then it's like discharging a battery. And it might take half an hour or an hour before they're ready to go again. Well, by using these recordings, it may be that you got the wolves to howl, didn't hear them, they were too far away. By the time at your next stop, a mile or so down or 2 miles down the road, and you blast it again, the wolves, hey, I've already howled, I'm not howling again for an hour or so, so don't answer you back. Whereas human howling, ours is not, you know, but a mile is about as much range you're going to be able to howl for, as it were, and hear, so that you're hearing the wolves in that range. Anyway, I did this for many summers.
So you were all by yourself in the middle of the wilderness. Correct. With wolves and bears and other predators, right? Was this scary? I mean, it must have been kind of scary.
You know, starting off having never worked with wolves before, to be sure it was scary, but you got kind of used to it. You know, periodically, I might get checked out by the wolves. If I sat at my camp very close to where they were, I'd take the loudspeaker and aim it the other way, out the tent. And then I would also try to record them out the front of my tent. My job was pretty cool in that sense. But you're hiking at night.
That's crazy.
You're using a flashlight.
By yourself.
Walking through the forest.
No phone.
No phone. None of that stuff existed in those days. And every couple of weeks, I'd come out, get more food, and hike back in again. It's a low, rolly country carpeted with maple trees with all these bogs everywhere, lakes everywhere, with spruce trees around them. And lots of them not on the map. That was the other thing. And the way you got around, you're dependent on your map and your compass. I mean, I come to live around that compass and learn that the compass is right a lot more than I am. And what happens is when you're hiking at night and you can't see very far, you tend to follow a contour. And so if you're on a slight hillside and it's just slightly bending around, you're actually slowly bending around. You think you're going a straight line, but you're actually curving slowly, whatever. So you can end up going lots of different directions. So you come to rely a lot on your compass to tell you what direction to go. And using a compass, if you don't have trails, and initially there were no trails in this area, that was the other problem. There was a trail to get into it, but no trail beyond that. You had to build some trails. You know, you're using game trails or whatever that you can actually use as trails. But I'd take tin lids with phosphorescent paint that I'd put on tin lids and tack these up on the trees. And I have as much as 10 miles worth of these trails that were built, trying to keep track of these wolves. And they moved around quite a bit. It was a bit tough because it was a large pack. And had an opportunity one time, my gosh, you know, here's found what's called a rendezvous site.
Will you explain what a rendezvous site is?
A rendezvous site, essentially, they'll go to the edges of a spruce bog, you know, a small, very small lake, and park their pups there. They're surrounded by these conifer trees. There'll be lots of adult beds under the various trees around it. And the pups have nothing to do for, you know, 2, 3, 4, or 5 days at a time. And they'll just romp and play, make little trails everywhere. And so that's a rendezvous site. And when they would move from one area to another, then I'd go in and map it all out. And working on this Fool's Lake pack, I'd lost my pack for a couple of nights. And I'm hiking along this primitive trail. And I hear howling down in the valley. And I think, oh, wonderful, I found my pack. So I leave my trail, work my way down through the brush and whatnot, get down towards the valley floor. And usually wolves, when they answer back, you know, you get a couple of howling sessions of answering back, and that might be it. It's like their batteries have discharged. But in this case, boy, are they ever cooperating. So almost every time I call, I'm getting them howling back. And so I'm absolutely delighted because I've got lots of compass bearings. I've figured out exactly, I think, whether you are on the map near to some creek. So as I get down this valley floor, I'm still a long ways from the creek. It's just I figured out where they are, so I'll be able to, you know, maybe set up a tent and so on. Well, I hear crash, crash, crash. And normally what happens, if you've maybe accidentally held someplace and you're too close to wolves, yeah, they'll check you out. Normally they just answer back. In this case, I wasn't too close, but normally what happens is that, you know, it's like a strange wolf in the area. They'll come check it out, and they come running like a bunch of dogs. They're not quiet about it at all. When they arrive on the scene, it's like they realize something's all haywire here. Normally what happens is you'll hear them shuffling around, sometimes quite close, because it goes real quiet. I mean, the moment they discover something's really wrong here, and they shuffle around, they get downwind of you, and they're out of there. They're gone. Don't want anything to do with you. That's the normal behavior. But in this one instant, this one wolf started to, it came about 100 yards or so away, and it started moving back and forth, and it was growling and barking. And growling and barking in wolves is an extreme threat. You know, they'll do it like a bear, get around their rendezvous site or something. It's rare that wolves get into this barking, but when they do, it's very distinct. Sounds like a, you know, big dog barking, basically. And I thought, God, this hasn't happened before. Now what do I do?
Oh my God.
And so I slowly backed up from tree to tree to trees. I'm working my way up the hill. And he carried on for 20 minutes and a half hour. He just went on and on and on with his barking and growling as I'm getting very, very far away from him. Well, he just kept this up. So I thought, man, I wasn't expecting this. I'm coming back here tomorrow to work on the wolves. And what happens now if I'm starting to have trouble with wolves?
You are really brave, like really brave that you went back.
And I think for all of us, there's a degree of discomfort moving around an area you can't see too well. You start to really become familiar with sounds around you. I went back with an axe. I went to where all the cross bearings were. And the wolves had scarfed up a deer. You know, just totally gone. It's a dozen wolves, and they had left. I think it's simply they'd eaten it all, and they're gone. I went back the next night and covered my whole 10 miles trail. Couldn't find them. I'm at the stage where I'm practically talking to myself. You know, I come out once a week or two and get food, and the rest I'm back in. And now I've been threatened by a wolf. From there on, I always had an assistant working with me. The reality, of course, it's like, no, I'm not going to get much by wolf. I'm not going to get much by bear. What is likely to happen in a true wilderness as this was, is that you fall and break a leg, you know, something serious happens to you. They would find after a week or two, if I haven't come out, to be sure, wolves are very capable animals. In parts of their range, they would live on bison. They would live on moose. I mean, these are staggeringly large animals that they're quite capable as a pack to hold down very large animals. Humans are a puny thing by comparison. I often ask myself, why is it that wolves don't kill people, or extremely rarely? I mean, it does exist, but it's almost totally off the charts. Unlike tigers and lions and leopards and cougars, and there's all kinds of predator bears, especially we have, up here every year, there may be a person or two that may get killed up here in Alaska from brown bears. That there's lots of big carnivores that do occasionally cross the line and kill humans. But why not wolves? And if you look at these different predators, it has a lot to do, I think, with how they're raised. Wolves, as a canid, all canids are involving both the mom and the dad in the care of the young. For most carnivores, that's not the case. In most carnivores, mom does all the work. If dad comes around, he's potentially dangerous, can be very lethal. Male bears will kill cubs if they can get them. That's more the norm. If you're a young male cougar, mom's teaching you what to catch, but you're still young, and the male shows up interested in her, his mom, so he's kicked out, basically. He's got to leave or get killed, basically. So now he's off trying to hunt with inappropriate skills. He's not fully trained yet, and he's a bit like a teenager at experimenting stage. So he's going to make mistakes. With wolves, they're a pack animal and have a very tight social structure. The leaders of the pack, that's usually mom and dad, not always, there'd be mixtures in that, but essentially the leaders of the pack are the ones that tell you where we're going tonight, where we're going to eat, what we're eating, where it is. That's all controlled, as it were. These young animals grow up beyond sexual maturity. So you've passed your imprinting stage of experimentation. You're now a firm adult, and you've been taught, hey, our diet is eating whatever it is, you know, deer, moose, whatever it is that's on the normal diet, elk, caribou. These are the things that we show you where to go, what to do night after night after night. And kind of like ourselves, once you've become entrenched as to what you eat and you're an adult, you're much less likely to experiment. So when you encounter somebody like a human, oh my God, now what? You know, that because it's not on the menu and you're not about to start testing. Plus, canids in general are a little on the shy side. They often scavenge if they get a chance to. The interesting thing is that in this hierarchy, it's like the top male and female get to breed. And the whole group, which is very unusual for a carnivore, the whole group feeds, you know, will bring food home in their stomachs, rebarf it up for the pups. That's a very unusual thing for a carnivore to do, to have the whole group of your assemblage. I think that's my best explanation as to why wolves don't eat people. in there, you know, I mean, they don't go out killing a bunch of people or something like that, or not even this series of rare encounters like you do with bears and cougars and leopards. It not even at that level. It's like almost Zippo.
The crazy thing about it is they don't eat people, yet they're the one carnivore that is pretty much hated, you know, globally.
Oh, I know.
And there's so many other carnivores that have caused a lot of damage to humans.
If you think of the contrast, the teddy bear, you know, the nice cuddly teddy bears, I am much more nervous, and I think with good reason, about teddy bears.
This was in the 60s, these summers.
Yes.
Was there at that time, I mean, you're in Canada, there weren't wolves in the U.S. yet. Or there were, but not many.
Yes.
But was there at that time, like the same kind of wolf hatred that's happening now?
Yes. In Ontario at that time, there was a bounty system going on, as over much of Canada, in fact, at the research station, there'd be wolf heads come in each year from these bountied animals that'd be boiled up because the skulls were kept for, you know, used for research, whatever. One interesting insight: the park interpretive staff in Algonquin asked us wolf researchers, you know, could we please have a public night, you know, hear wolves, because they kept after us, which was the right thing to do in terms of get people involved. Because I think that's the key to having people get rid of their fears about things, trying to understand what's real and what's not real. We asked them how many people, when we agreed that we'd do something, that they'd had. I said, well, the most they'd ever had to anything was 80 people. And we said, 80 people? How are we going to handle 80 people? But anyway, they kept after us, and we agreed that there'd be a parking lot we'd have the people go to. We would go the night before and howl up and down this piece of highway. There's about 50 miles that cuts a corner, one corner of this park. If we found any wolf packs next near the highway, then we would take the public there the next evening so they could hear these wolves. We found a wolf pack, and we went the next evening to pick up the public. Over 600 people showed up. I mean, we couldn't even get near the parking lot. It was kind of crazy. 600 people, that's 3/4 mile long of cars when you take them down a highway. That's a huge train. As we were driving along with this huge train trying to take them where the wolves were, the RCMP, the police showed up, and they were furious about the fact they hadn't been informed that this was we didn't know either. This might be dealing with. So anyway, we parked. We got the people at each end to walk up to the middle. We howled, and when the wolves responded, you could have heard a pin drop. I mean, these two, just like for the first time in their lives, for this vast number of people, they're hearing wolves in the wild at night. You know, just it's a terrific opportunity for them. But because this was under a period where intense wolf management was going on, the wolves being killed, essentially, it's like they get $5 or something on the bounty for each animal that they could prove that they'd actually got. Because there's all this, you know, general understanding of wolves are bad, et cetera, and government programs to encourage that. They didn't want a word out about the fact that 600 people had shown up to this. But word got out, and the interpretive staff were also so pleased by the fact that, you know, all this mass education has suddenly occurred on this event, that they turned it into an annual event. As many as 2,000 people show up to hear wolves howling at night under the stars. There's a wolf listening society that's been created. These are mostly people around in canoes and all the rest, and you know, so it's organized that way as well.
How cool.
Yeah, I know. I mean, I think it's a fabulous opportunity to educate. You know, what is, you know, they don't howl at the moon. what causes wolves to howl? Well, in springtime, they don't howl much. I think it's maybe if they're denning, it's vulnerable. You know, you don't. This is a vulnerable site, and if they happen to be away, maybe a bear or something will get them. But as the summer starts to progress, initially, the wolves will respond, it's like it begins to build, and the pups will join the adults. They'll start their little yippies and whatever, but not the they won't do it on their own until you start to get towards about July. Sometime in July, they'll start to howl on their own. When that happens, daytime, nighttime, frogs croaking, that's enough. Slam a car door, they'll howl. Loons call, they'll howl. They'll howl at just about anything. And it's at that time of year that I think is great from public interpretation time, because you're not really disturbing anything. You don't need to worry to take people out to howl so they can hear wolves and talk about what howling is. It's this territorial thing that's used. Maybe I'll demonstrate for you, actually. I've done this for years. I don't know how my throat probably
would
work.
I would love it.
I'll demonstrate a wolf howl, but I'm going to compare it for you with a coyote that we would hear a lot of coyotes. And coyotes, just their yippee-yippee type of thing, it's really almost impossible to tell that from wolf pups. So you want to remove, you know, it's like you may hear what you hope are wolves, but in fact are coyotes. And we'll try to demonstrate. It's going to be loud also.
That's
maybe
okay.
I'll do it facing away or something. Kind of wimpy there. It's been a long time. So I'd go on there only much longer. My voice is shorter now. But a coyote sound is yay-yay-yee! That high pitch, yay-yay-yee, going straight up. Wolves don't do that. If you hear that, you're dealing with coyotes.
Okay.
Whereas the yippee yippee stuff can be puppies, but this yay-yay-yee, that rapid rise in sound, wolves don't seem to do that. So that's what we use in our survey techniques. And we did that not only in the northern states. We did that in the southwestern states looking for red wolves in the early days. And then at Wolf Haven, we did quite a bit of work too with the Mexican wolves. They were thought to be extinct in the lower 48, but we worked with the agencies, trained up a bunch for the howling and all the rest of it, and volunteer groups as well. And work around the very southern borders in hope that maybe there's some, because there's some pretty wild country, that we might turn up wolves. We ran into some wolf hybrid issues. That's a separate thing. It's a real pain in the neck for fish and wildlife, where people sometimes will try releasing their pet hybrid that didn't work out for them as these animals mature and they can't handle them.
That's great. Paul, thank you so much. This was incredible to hear these stories and to hear about your life and to hear about your crazy first couple summers in the dark.
Well, let's hope that more of a conservation ethic can be acquired. Part of the reason I got involved in endangered species was because with carnivores, over half of all recently extinct mammals are predators. And when you think of it, it makes sense. They're the apex, they're at the very top in terms of there's not many of them to start with. The idea that wolves, not just you have to worry about them eating people, are going to wipe out all the prey. No, the way nature's developed itself, it's like it has to be a win-win. If it's not a win-win, it's not going to work. So, through combinations of wolves having territories and all the rest of it. I mean, essentially what you're doing, you're tending to take the sick and the weak. The weak can be calves, but you're taking the surplus, so to speak, as it were. And in that sense, you prevent, from a predator standpoint, you're actually preventing overgrazing, overbrowsing. I mean, there's quite a strong dynamic between how nature's evolved all this to the benefit of both. It's not a perfect world. Things go wrong from time to time. But this idea that the predators are out there to scarf everything up is very, very wrong. It's all part of how nature works, and we need to be respectful of that.
Let's hope it changes, Paul. I hope so. Well, thank you.
Well, thank you for the opportunity to be a part of your podcast.
To learn more about Paul and to learn about his work, go to our website, speciesunite.com. We will have links to everything. While you're there, if you're not a subscriber, sign up. We are on Facebook and Instagram at Species Unite. If you have a spare moment and could do us a favor, subscribe, rate, review on Apple Podcasts or wherever you listen to podcasts. If you would like to support the podcast, we would greatly appreciate it. Go to our website, speciesunite.com, and click donate. I would like to thank everyone at Species Unite, including Gary Knudsen, Caitlin Pierce, Amy Jones, Paul Healy, Santina Polke, and Anna Kallner, who wrote and performed today's music. Thank you for listening. Have a wonderful day.